time is now 6 o'clock on the dot, and welcome to WORT's local news for Thursday, April 11th. I'm your host, Marcus Slayton.
And I'm Christina Leffering. In tonight's news, a Wisconsin Supreme Court justice won't run for re-election next year when she'll reach 30 years on the top court.
The incoming superintendent of Madison Schools greeted students this morning ahead of his move back home.
And an investigation is underway into a Northside shooting last night, which police say is the first homicide of 2024.
Plus, local fishers see high waters, and we catch up with the Madison Flamingos ahead of a league opener this weekend.
All these and more on tonight's news. But first, let's go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. President Biden has said the U.S. is ready to defend Manila from any attack in the South China Sea as he hosts the leaders of Japan and the Philippines at a summit in the White House. There have been repeated confrontations between Chinese and Philippine vessels in waters off disputed islands. Mr. Biden said any attack on Philippine aircraft, vessels or armed forces would invoke the Mutual Defense Treaty.
When we stand as one, we're able to forge a better future for all. And that's what this new trilat is all about, in my view. Building a better future for people across the Indo-Pacific and, quite frankly, beyond, around the world.
Mexico has asked the UN's top court to suspend Ecuador from the world body over the storming of its embassy in Quito. Mexican officials filed a complaint demanding a public apology for the raid in which the former Ecuadorian vice president, Jorge Glass, was arrested. Will Grant reports.
Last week, Ecuadorian police entered Mexico's diplomatic mission in Quito to arrest Ecuador's former vice president, Jorge Glass, in scenes which have prompted widespread condemnation around the world and across the political spectrum in Mexico. Mr. Glass was dragged out of the building. The Ecuadorian president, Daniel Noboa, has refused to apologize for the incident, saying Ecuador's people reject any kind of impunity for criminals, corruption or narco-terrorists. Former Vice President Glass was facing embezzlement charges and had been living inside Mexico's embassy since December.
About 10 million residents of the Colombian capital Bogotá and the surrounding areas are facing crippling water shortages due to a severe drought aggravated by the El Niño climate phenomenon. With the authorities rationing water supplies, the region will be split into 9 zones, each zone taking it in turn to switch off water services for 24 hours. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has called on his counterparts in countries from Europe to China to help dissuade Iran from launching a retaliatory strike against Israel. Iran blames Israel for the airstrike on its consulate in Syria that killed 7 military commanders. The US has warned Iran against the escalation it's promised. At a news conference, a spokesman for the Israel Defense Forces, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, said they were prepared for a possible attack.
An attack from Iranian territory would be clear proof of Iran's intentions to escalate the situation in the Middle East and stop hiding behind proxies. In the last few months, we've improved and advanced our offensive capabilities and will know how to act where needed.
BBC News. Hamas has said that only a ceasefire in Gaza can provide the conditions for it to be able to locate Israeli hostages held in the territory. Mediated negotiations in Cairo on a deal to exchange hostages for Palestinian prisoners during a 6-week truce have apparently stalled. President Putin has said airstrikes on Ukraine's energy grid, which have caused extensive blackouts, form part of Moscow's attempts to demilitarize its adversary. His comment, made during talks with his ally, the Belarusian president Alexander Lukashenko, came after another wave of Russian strikes against Ukraine's energy facilities. State television in Niger says Russian military instructors have arrived in Niamey to train the National Army. It aired footage of equipment being unloaded from a military cargo plane as people in fatigue stood by. One said he was there to develop military cooperation between Russia and Niger. The West African country has pivoted towards Moscow since the junta seized power in a coup last year, breaking long-standing ties with France. The U.S. Coast Guard says it's rescued three castaways stranded on an uninhabited Pacific island. The three men were fishing when their boat's motor failed and their radio battery ran out. Here's Stephanie Zacherson.
The initial search area was nearly 270,000 square kilometres and the weather conditions were poor. But the crew of a reconnaissance aircraft spotted a makeshift sign. On the beach of a tiny island, they could read the word help, spelled out with large leaves from palm trees covering the white sand. It was a crucial factor in the discovery of the men, allowing the plane to airdrop survival packages and a radio to the stranded trio. They radioed back, saying they were in good health. The next day, the castaways were picked up by the Coast Guard.
This is Marcus Slayton and Christina Leffering with your local news coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. And here are tonight's headlines. State Supreme Court Justice Ann Walsh Bradley announced today she won't seek re-election in 2025. She'll have served 30 years on the state's top court when she retires next summer. We'll get the scoop on what this means for the court's narrow liberal majority with WIS Politics editor J.R. Ross in a few minutes.
A man convicted of the 2022 firebombing of an anti-abortion group's Madison office has been sentenced to 7.5 years in federal prison. The Wisconsin State Journal reports that Harindu Roy Chowdhury pleaded guilty in December to bombing the office of Wisconsin Family Action. U.S. District Judge William Conley emphasized during the sentencing Wednesday that the firebombing was not just arson, but an act of terrorism. The bombing occurred 6 days after the U.S. Supreme Court draft opinion overturning Roe v. Wade was leaked to the public.
The Menominee Nation has sued TikTok and several other social media providers, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. They claim social media addiction is contributing to their rate of teen suicide. Nationally, the suicide rate for Native American teenagers is 3.5 times higher than the national average, according to the Center for Native American Youth. And the Centers for Disease Control reports that Native American teenage girls are 5 times more likely to kill themselves than white teen girls. The lawsuit also names Snapchat, YouTube, Facebook parent Meta, and Google as defendants. And lawyers from the Menominee Nation allege these companies have designed their apps to exploit the psychology of children. The Spirit Lake Tribe of North Dakota has joined in the lawsuit, and more tribes are expected to follow suit, the Journal Sentinel reports.
Plastic litter is the single most common type of trash found on the Great Lakes shoreline, a 20-year Alliance for the Great Lakes study has concluded. Of the material picked up by volunteers, 86% was partially or completely made of plastic, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. As plastic degrades into smaller pieces, microplastic fragments can find their way into the bodies of animals and people, studies have found. The prevalence of plastic trash shows that fundamental changes should be made to the way plastics are used.
A collision course of rising home prices and interest rates have put a crimp into Wisconsin's housing market, a University of Wisconsin real estate expert says. Home sales in the state are down 29% since 2021, Mark Ipley told the audience at a business luncheon Wednesday, sponsored by WIS Politics, WIS Business, and the Wisconsin Bankers Association. The Capital Times reports that Ipley described the pinch as part of a long-standing national trend. People aren't moving as often as they used to. In the 1980s, around 20% of Americans moved each year. But in 2021, just 8.4% of Americans moved into another home. That's creating a housing shortage in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country, Ipley said.
The first phase of plans to redevelop a large swath of public housing at Washington Avenue and Park Street has been submitted by Madison's Community Development Authority. The master plan is to replace 5 residential buildings containing 336 housing units in the area with a complex containing more than 1,200 units, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. Plans submitted Monday for the first phase focus on a new five-story, 164-unit building to be erected at the corner of Braxton Place and La Mariposa Lane. Construction is scheduled to begin later this year. The redevelopment plans are phased to ensure that no residents are displaced, according to the State Journal.
A Dane County supervisor's transition from a board seat to a job as chief of staff of the body has some supervisors calling for changes to the board's ethics code. Former supervisor Cecilia Castillo raised eyebrows when she quietly resigned to take the chief of staff job with a current annual salary of over $131,000, the Capital Times reports. Supervisor Rick Rose has proposed two amendments to the ethics code that would bar sitting board members from applying for other county jobs.
It's Tornado Awareness Week in Wisconsin, a highlight of which was to be two severe weather warnings today, complete with sirens sounding statewide at 1:45 and 6:45 p.m. However, conditions that could produce tornadoes are actually present in some parts of the state this evening, prompting the National Weather Service and its partners to cancel the second siren drill, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. So if you hear a siren go off in your area this evening, take cover immediately. Those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
Last year, Madison had 10 intentional homicide cases, nearly double from the year prior. Four of those homicides stemmed from domestic violence. At a press conference this afternoon, Madison Police Chief Sean Barnes reiterated the importance of domestic violence resources and community involvement after what police say is the city's first intentional homicide case of 2024. WORT News producer Faye Parks has the story.
Easley and her partner, an unnamed 31-year-old man, were attending a small party outside a Northside apartment building.
Last night, around 6:30 p.m., our team responded to a shooting at the apartment building along the 1900 block of North Port Drive. As our officers arrived, they found a man suffering from a gunshot wound. He was pronounced dead at the hospital late last night.
Chief Barnes says that law enforcement quickly identified Beasley as a suspect, thanks to surveillance footage at the apartment building. Beasley fled the scene, but came back in the early hours of the morning and turned herself in. She was booked in the Dane County Jail a few hours later under tentative charges of first-degree intentional homicide. Beasley has a black eye in her mugshot. According to Chief Barnes, law enforcement were not responsible for her injury.
We know that she was arrested without incident from us.
And the building's surveillance video doesn't show Beasley being struck, as she and the victim move in and out of frame.
Seconds matter. So we don't know the full extent, which is why our officers and our detectives, will be working hard to kind of find the people who were there, encourage them to give us a full and accurate account of what they may have heard or what they may have seen on that case.
Chief Barnes says that MPD has never responded to a domestic call for the couple before yesterday evening, but they were involved in a domestic incident in Illinois. And according to Chief Barnes, they're working with Chicago law enforcement to get more information on that case. Chief Barnes reiterated today the importance of domestic violence awareness.
I've stood here several times during the course of my tenure here, and what we know is true is that the biggest predictor of violence is a preceding case of violence. We need our community to help us out, to call early, to call often, and of course never intervene beyond the scope of your training. But we depend and we really rely on our community.
And in his most recent State of Public Safety address in February, Chief Barnes said that reducing gun-related crimes is one of his top priorities for this year. Shots fired incidents were on the decline last year, decreasing by nearly one-fifth. He told the press today that yesterday's incident was especially alarming.
What I found disturbing was, the time of day. There's also a playground in the vicinity. If you go to the scene, you can see that where children were playing and trying to enjoy a nice day, which means that we have to do a better job.
Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
After a long search process, Madison Metropolitan School District has a new superintendent. Dr. Joe Gothard previewed some of his priorities for the district at a press conference this morning. Reporter Sarah Gabler was there.
It's not one person, it's a team. Team. Let's try it again. It's not one person, it's a
team.
It's a team. It really is.
That was Dr. Joe Gothard addressing students at Thoreau Elementary School this morning. Gothard is the new superintendent of the Madison Metropolitan School District, and at today's press conference, he spoke directly to students about his commitment to their learning. This new job is personal to Gothard, who both attended Madison schools before becoming a teacher and later principal at Toki Middle School and later La Follette High School.
I reflected greatly on making sure that this was indeed the right fit, that I could come back to Madison and be a successful superintendent, but more importantly, that I could help facilitate your success. And I'm looking at students, I'm looking at staff, I'm looking at the greater Madison community as well. I want Madison to be successful.
For Madison Board of Education members, bringing Gothard back to Madison to fill this role was a no-brainer. Lisa Quistad, interim superintendent of MMSD, says she's glad Gothard got the job.
One of my key goals when I started this position was to ensure that there was a strong foundation so that the Board of Education could do their most important work this year, and that was to hire a great superintendent for Madison. And they did it. They hired Dr. Joe Gothard.
Thoreau Elementary students had a chance to ask Gothard questions about his role.
How will you handle all your job responsibilities? We have 50 plus schools and there are so many students, staffs, and families.
It's a lot of responsibility. It definitely is. I have 68 schools right now, so I know what it feels like to have a lot of schools. But here's what I'll say. Remember when I talked about people being at the center, one of my first priorities? Remember when I talked about team and together? This work is not about one person, not about one leader. So a lot of the leaders that you see around here today are those who are also deeply responsible for caring about and doing great work for our school district.
Gothard will face real challenges in this role, from narrowing the achievement gap to responding to projected funding shortages. Gothard says he's willing to take feedback and make changes to shrink the achievement gap.
You will not address achievement gaps, opportunity gaps, unless you know your community and know what assets lie within your community. That's where it has to start. I think that we've got to be very deliberate. I think we've got to be very open with our community around where our challenges are, report frequently about progress that we're making, and not be afraid at all to say, you know what, we're not making the mark here. A first year, first time superintendent, that might be really hard to do. I have no problem saying that this didn't meet the mark. Community, you deserve better. Students, you absolutely deserve better. And we have to do something different.
When asked about the budget, Gothard says public education isn't funded like it should be. He sees a path to increase funds for specialized service through collective action. And as the city of Madison grows, he sees an opportunity to increase school funds by increasing enrollment.
How can we innovate to make the Madison Metropolitan School District the destination school district, not just in Dane County, but in this state?
Gothard also outlines some of his priorities for this new role. He says it will be important to build relationships with the Board of Education, understand how students are learning, engage with the community, and amplify what MMSD does well. Gothard says he's pleased by innovations in programming like the student-centered design at La Follette High School, which was recently renovated, as well as the service work done by the Black Girl Magic program at LVM Elementary School. And though he's proud of MMSD's dual language immersion programs, he says there is room for improvement by making them accessible to more students. Gothard will take on these challenges when he starts the job on May 20th. He's slated to make $299,000 a year in the role. In the meantime, Lisa Quistad will round out the school year as interim superintendent. For WORT News, I'm Sarah Gabler.
We'll be right back.
The time is now 6:20 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. Today, State Supreme Court Justice Ann Walsh Bradley announced she is not seeking re-election in 2025 when her current term is set to expire. J.R. Ross is editor of WisPolitics, a multimedia news outlet that covers politics, the government, and business. This afternoon, he told WORT news producer Faye Parks that this unexpected shakeup could jeopardize the court's liberal majority.
Thank you for joining me, J.R.
Oh, sure, anytime.
So there are two Justice Bradleys on the state Supreme Court, and we're talking about the more liberal-leaning Ann Walsh Bradley. She's served on the court for almost 30 years. And can you walk us through some of her more notable moments or actions during that tenure?
Oh, well, believe it or not, in 2005, she was even opposed for re-election. That's how Supreme Court races used to be in Wisconsin. If you were incumbent, you were kind of untouchable. Their things include, in 2011, she accused then-Justice David Prosser of trying to choke her during a contentious meeting in chambers about a decision from the court on Act 10. 2015, she won re-election with 58% of the vote. She was a longtime ally of Justice Shirley Abramson. They were there when the court went from a 5-2 conservative majority. Then she watched as it went back in 2018, 2020, and 2023 to give back liberals the majority, first time in 15 years. She's been a long time, kind of steady, well-respected jurist from a different time. I mean, she's from a time when Supreme Court races were about your endorsements and, you know, your law enforcement backing and your experience. They weren't these kind of really expensive, high-profile campaigns. It's a much different time in Wisconsin politics and with Wisconsin judiciary.
And so right now, nearly all of the state Supreme Court justices are women. Do you know what the court looked like when Justice Bradley was first elected, especially since you referenced that incident with David Prosser and just how things have changed over time?
Overwhelmingly male. You know, that was the way it was for a long time. It's been interesting. For whatever reason, female candidates have had a good run in Wisconsin with Supreme Court races. Obviously, Brian Hagedorn, a conservative who sometimes sides the liberal majority on things or the old liberal minority on things. He's the only man on the court. And for progressives, it's been an interesting profile that they've gravitated toward for candidates, sitting judges who are former prosecutors and are women. And it's worked. In 2018, Rebecca Dallet won. In 2020, Jill Karofsky. In 2023, Janet Prosser, which all three check all three of those boxes with their backgrounds.
And so you mentioned before the sort of flip-flopping back and forth between a conservative and a liberal majority. And most recently, just a few months ago, it flipped back to a liberal majority for the first time in 15 years. So Justice Bradley is choosing to step down at the end of her term, meaning that Governor Evers will not be able to appoint an interim justice. How might that impact the court's leaning?
So the big thing is that, one, control of the court is going to be up for grabs in 2025 no matter what. But now you've got a race without an incumbent in it. Incumbents in Wisconsin typically do pretty well when it comes to Supreme Court races. If you go back, the first time a Supreme Court justice lost a re-election was 1967. That justice of the Supreme Court happened to, one, be within 2 years of a mandatory retirement age back in the day, and two, had signed an opinion that allowed the old Milwaukee Braves to leave the city and go to Atlanta. So it wasn't a great combination for him. From 67 until 2008, nobody lost. In 2008, Lewis Butler had been appointed by then-Governor Jim Doyle, lost his bid to retain a seat on the court. And in 2020, then-Justice Daniel Kelly lost his bid to retain a seat after he was appointed by Scott Walker. So we really don't have a lot of experience where justices have been elected lose. So that would have been big for progressives slash Democrats to have an incumbent who's won statewide before three times, a proven fundraiser, and a very important race. If liberals hold the court in 2025, they are guaranteed to keep the majority for at least another several years, because in 2026, you'd have Rebecca Bradley up for election. She's a conservative. In 2027, it'll be Annette Ziegler, another conservative. So you would have some breathing room until you had control for a while. Now you've got an open seat. It makes it more challenging. The flip side is you're not going to have a candidate on the progressive side who has the long track record that Ann Walsh Bradley does. In addition to three terms on the Supreme Court, she was a Marathon County judge. And in 2015, opponents pulled out decisions that she'd made while a circuit court judge used against her. You're probably going to have as deep a well of research to do. Now, for Republicans or conservatives, they have Brad Schimmel, a former Republican attorney general. He has already announced he's in the race. There also is Maria Lazar, a member of the 2nd District Court of Appeals in Waukesha County, or based in Waukesha, I'm sorry. She said she's considering it. What I'm watching now is you have an open spot in the court. Will others jump in, or will others take a look? at running for this seat, because now it's not taking on an incumbent, but a chance to win an open seat.
And I'm sorry, you mentioned a few folks have announced that they would like to run for the open seat. Are any of them liberal-leaning that you know of?
Oh, yeah. A couple that have talked about it. Susan Crawford, a Dane County Circuit Court judge. Chris Taylor, a appeals court judge in the 4th District based out of Madison. Susan Crawford used to be chief legal counsel for then-Governor Jim Doyle. She's a former member of the Department of Assistant Attorney General of the Department of Justice. She is a sitting circuit court judge, so she's got that background. Chris Taylor was, I think, policy director for Planned Parenthood, spent 9 years at Assembly, was appointed to the Dane County Circuit Court by Governor Evers in 2020. Then she won a seat on the 4th District unopposed in 2023. So those are at least a couple people who look at it. And again, this is very fresh. Like, people were thinking about, okay, on the liberal side, I might want to run for the Supreme Court maybe in 2026 or 27. Those races are coming up. They weren't expecting to see this so soon. So people are going to take some time. And, you know, sometimes, though, if you are a Chris Taylor or Susan Crawford, if you get out there quickly ahead of others, it can kind of help you get a head start on solidifying support for what's going to be a very important race.
And so, of course, we spoke about Justice Janet Protasiewicz, who just recently was elected. And that was the most expensive race for Supreme Court in Wisconsin history. Do you anticipate a repeat of that in this coming election?
Well, good question. I've had a couple of people tell me today they think it will. I personally counted $56 million spent in that 2023 race. I've been told by operatives much more is probably spent, like several million more. That's just not trackable. So one of the big questions is, how does that race develop? And can the Republican Party of Wisconsin match the fundraising prowess of the Democratic Party? So far, we haven't seen that. The Democratic Party in recent years has been a fundraising machine. The party gave Protasiewicz $10 million almost in 2023. The Republican Party did not give nearly as much to Dan Kelly in that race. So one thing that will determine is how invested do Republican and conservative groups get? Democrats have proven already once in Wisconsin they will go to the hilt, spend what it takes to win a seat. Can Republicans match that? That might help determine the final price of that race in 2025.
And so, of course, Justice Bradley is still on the court. Are there any notable cases before she steps down? Anything we should keep an eye on?
Oh, abortion for sure. There's the challenge, the 1849 abortion law that is a for the justices. There'll be a number of election-related cases coming up to watch, because the state Supreme Court has huge say in how elections are run, especially with an elections commission that's often deadlocked between the partisan appointees. So that court's going to be really in the spotlight, because Wisconsin's going to matter once again in the presidential race, plus there's a whole high-profile U.S. Senate race. So whether there are drop boxes allowed for absentee ballots, for example, what the standards are for a witness information on an absentee ballot envelope, those are all going to be issues that the court could decide. If you know, this fall, that could help determine how ballots are counted in November.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, JR.
Sure. Have a good one.
That was JR Ross, editor of WIS Politics, on Justice Anne Walsh Bradley's announcement that she is leaving the state Supreme Court at the end of her term in July of 2025.
And you're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Please stay with us. We've got lots more stories coming up.
Stories like, can you hold a public meeting in a private home? How hard is it to fish in high waters? And are you ready for some soccer this weekend?
But first, we'll take a quick break, check in on some world headlines, and we'll be right back.
Do you care about workers and labor issues? Do you want to make a difference in our community for working people? Then join the Labor Radio team. Labor Radio is a weekly show that covers labor, social justice, and political issues that impact workers. And we need your help. As a Labor Radio volunteer, you will have the opportunity to report on important labor and social justice stories in your community, interview workers, activists, and experts, produce and edit your own stories. No prior experience is necessary, though a connection with labor is a plus. We will provide training and support. All you need is a passion for worker justice and a desire to amplify the voices of working people. To learn more, contact Volunteer Coordinator Adrian Rainey at 608-321-9583 or head online to wortfm.org/volunteer to fill out an application. Labor Radio, a voice for workers.
BBC News. Hosting a summit in the White House with the leaders of Japan and the Philippines, President Biden has said the United States is ready to defend Manila from any attack in the South China Sea. There's been repeated confrontations between Chinese and Philippine vessels there. Mexico has demanded Ecuador's suspension from the United Nations over its raid on the Mexican embassy in Quito last Friday. In a lawsuit filed before the International Court of Justice, Mexico accused President Daniel Noboa of violating diplomatic law. About 10 million residents of the Colombian capital Bogotá and the surrounding areas are facing crippling water shortages due to a severe drought aggravated by the El Niño climate phenomenon. The UN World Food Programme has warned its stocks in Haiti could run out in a month as a surge in gang violence disrupts food distribution. The US Secretary of State has called on his counterparts in countries from Europe to China to help dissuade Iran from launching a retaliatory strike against Israel. Iran blames Israel for the airstrike on its consulate in Syria, killing 7 military commanders. President Putin has said airstrikes on Ukraine's energy grid, which have caused extensive blackouts, form part of Moscow's attempts to demilitarize its adversary. State television in Niger says Russian military instructors have arrived in Niamey to train the National Army. The West African country has pivoted towards Moscow since the junta seized power last year. The US Justice Department has announced it will expand background checks on firearms, requiring anyone engaged in the business of selling guns to register as a federally licensed dealer. BBC News.
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Marcus Slayton, here with co-host Christina Leffering. Thanks for joining us.
Today on Transparency Talk, can a local school board legally hold a meeting in a private home? Does the public need to be invited? Those questions and many more are at the center of Tom Kamenick's latest case with the Wisconsin Transparency Project. Kamenick joins WORT's Dylan Brogan to tell us more about it. A quick note that this conversation isn't specific legal advice, so seek an attorney's assistance if you have difficulty with open records.
Tom, thank you for joining me again on Transparency Talk. How are you?
Hey, Dylan, I'm doing good. How about you?
I'm doing great. Excited to hear about this new case you've been working on. So set up the background for us on this one. It has to do with a superintendent of a school?
With the Raymond School District, and the superintendent is only one bit player in all of this. So Raymond School District is a very small district in Racine County. They have one building, and it's a K-8. So they feed into the public school district, but they're separate from it. Big controversies going on in this small school district here. You know, among other things, the principal for the school was placed on leave under allegations of misconduct. He countered back, filing a complaint saying he's being discriminated against because he's gay. They've had issues with books in the school library on the school board. The interim superintendent faced criticism. More recently has resigned underneath all of this. And here's what's underlying.
Yeah, I was going to say a lot going on in the Raymond School District. So how does open records fit into all this?
And none of that is even part of our lawsuit, really. And this is a meetings lawsuit. So the school board there in Raymond has been holding private retreats, they call them, at a board member's house. They meet there, they discuss goals, they decide what areas to focus on, they have discussions about the school district, but they tell us no formal votes are taken or decisions are made.
Okay, well, so doesn't that violate quorum rules or public noticing rules?
Yeah, it violates all kinds of rules. You you can't hold a public meeting in a private house and say that's good enough. So what happened here specifically is December 2022, so this is actually a year and a half ago or so, they held one of these retreats at a board member's house. They not just discussed goals again, but they actually got deep into the search, their ongoing search for a permanent superintendent, because the superintendent at the time, his name was Michael Garvey, and he was only an interim superintendent at the time. The superintendent admitted in later emails that they had discussed these things and that there was actually at least a consensus that they would keep the superintendent, keep Garvey on, have the superintendent position be part-time instead of full-time. Public didn't know about this until after the retreat happened. Now, it's interesting is once that happened, they actually tried to hold another one of these retreats later in August of 2023. Public got wind of this one. A bunch of people started posting saying, hey, we're going to come to this lady's house, this board member's house, and we're going to sit in on this meeting. And then they canceled it.
Anytime the board meets like this, I mean, they're clearly talking about school business, right? Like, it's
That is a meeting. It doesn't matter if they don't make decisions or not.
You could have it at a Denny's and they need, it's not that they can only have the meeting in a school district building, but they could have it outside in a park, but you have to let the public know about it, let the public attend it, right? Unless you get in a closed session. Like,
exactly.
What should have happened that didn't?
This didn't fit under any closed session exemptions. Even if it had, you still have to start an open session and have proper public notice. They didn't have proper public notice. You are allowed to hold a government board meeting, a governmental body meeting at a private location, so long as it's still big enough to hold your normal crowds and so long as you provide public notice of it. But you know, one of the claims we have in this lawsuit is this house was not going to hold the 20 or 30 people who were attending the normal monthly board meetings on a regular basis during all these controversies that were going on, which is 20 to 30 or sometimes even more people. They weren't going to get inside this house.
Yeah. So tell us where the lawsuit comes in. So who are your clients in this, and what were you, why was a legal action needed to be filed?
So my client is Mitchell Berman. He is an active community member down there and has been attending a lot of the regular meetings and speaking up about these things. He filed his verified complaint with the Racine County District Attorney, like you're supposed to do, investigated by the sheriff. Now, the sheriff's report concluded that there was no violation. However, there's a lot of things that report seems to have missed. One is that during the investigation, the district, for the first time, produced agendas and minutes for this December retreat that did not exist before that. They were not placed on the website. They were not available. And my client suspects that they were actually created after the fact, told the sheriff, hey, they just gave you a PDF or maybe it was even a paper document. Ask them for the electronic file so you can see when it was created. You know, they didn't do that. So my client goes to the school district. Here's another outrageous thing the district did. Is my client goes to the school district, goes to the office, says, hey, I want to make a record request. I want to see these agendas and minutes, the original copies of those, which you have every right to do. Not only do they not provide them to him, the principal escorted him out of the building and put the school on a lockdown, claiming he was a threat to safety. Now, my client has the recording of this interaction. He had that going. He was calm. He was polite. And if you listen to it, it's the school secretary, who started getting rude and really angry and nasty back.
I don't know how the sheriff couldn't have found that they weren't violating the law. I mean, did they let people know that the meeting was happening or the retreat was happening?
So the district claims that notice was posted, but a lot of things bring that claim into doubt. One is the agenda for it and the minutes, those documents did not exist until they were created afterwards. What's a little weird is that one person from the public did attend the meeting, but nobody could explain how he knew about this retreat. Because when they did make it publicly, when they did publicly notice the August one, a whole bunch of people said, yeah, we're going to come to this. And then they said, well, no, actually, we're going to cancel it. You know, they didn't say why, but it was pretty clear from context that board member whose house this was didn't want a massive crowd of people at their house.
Yes, probably why you shouldn't have a public meeting at your house.
You've got the superintendent on record saying this is not the public's meeting, referring to these kind of retreats. And that just shows a clear contempt for public access and public transparency.
Yeah, so what is your client hope to achieve? What is he hoping is the outcome?
Yeah, we want a ruling from the judge that this was illegal. The district has been using the sheriff report as kind of an exoneration. See, we didn't do anything wrong. We think that's completely off base. My client wants it on the record that you cannot do this. These are illegal meetings. Nobody can do this. You know,
so they don't do it again.
So they don't do it again. So other districts around the state don't do it again. So cities and villages and towns don't do something like this. You can't have these private retreats for your board members.
Because, hey, if they can do it in Raymond, the Raymond School District, where else can they do it, right?
This one raises my hackles. So remember, everybody, if you don't go, you won't know.
Last weekend's rains means that the rivers around Dane County are higher than normal. But that doesn't mean that there isn't good fishing to be had. Nate Wiegehout and Pat Hansberg break down what's happening on this week's Fishy Business.
Alrighty, I'm on the line now with Pat Hansberg over at the DNS Bait Shop here in Madison. Pat, the last weekend, we were just talking before we were recording, last weekend, not the nicest weekend to get out fishing. I think I actually did get out a little bit, and the weekend before that, but this upcoming weekend, it's going to look very nice, maybe even hitting 70 degrees. So perfect time to get out there and hit the water. So let's just kick off right there. Pat, how has the fishing been lately?
It's been good. This warmer weather definitely has the fish in a better mood, but it also has the anglers in a better mood. You know, that, like you were saying, it's been so cold and damp for so long that, you know, once we get to, even when we were only, you know, getting 45 degrees and sunny, we had quite a few folks coming through the shop and getting out. And now, of course, like you're saying, with the temperatures close to 70 degrees, we're going to be getting a lot of people out there, and rightfully so. It's a great time to be out fishing.
And let's move down the list, starting off with Lake Mendota. What's happening over there?
Well, you know, with game fish season still being closed, that opens on May 4th, so not too far away anymore. But, you know, there aren't a lot of people getting out in the main lakes, but a lot of your shallow bays are starting to hold fish. So up here on the north side, Cherokee and the Cherokee Park area is starting to have a few bluegills and a few crappies show up in there as that water warms up. The 113 Bridge area has had some good crappies moving through there as well, and some mostly smaller perch, but a lot of perch in there. And all the shallow bays around the lake, you know, I'm talking about where Pheasant Branch comes in on the west side, Marshall Park, Spring Harbor, University Bay, and Tenney Park as well, above the locks, of course. Below the locks at Tenney Park is closed right now as a fish refuge. But any shallow areas around Mendota have been holding fish, and that'll just get better now as soon as things warm up.
And now what about Lake Monona? What's happening there?
Same thing down there. You got where the Yahara dumps in on the northwest end of the lake. Is a great kind of early season spot. That current draws a lot of fish in there. Otherwise, Monona Bay has been fishing well and will continue to get better with some good crappies in there. So they're fishing in the Triangles area and along Brittingham Park and getting fish from shore, but also folks in boats. Folks are getting fish up in Lake Wingra, a lot of smaller panfish, but bass season is open now, early bass, so that's catch and release. But there are some absolute giant bass in there, and while the weeds are still down, it's a great opportunity to chase those fish. The area below the Winger Dam is, of course, closed also as a fish refuge right now. But other areas, any shallow bays, so Turvo Bay, Weechawuk Bay, up in the Winnequa Park Lagoon area is also a great spot that holds fish this time of year. So lots of great areas to get to. Oh, and south of the lake there at Lattice Park, down sort of where the old Rutabaga used to be down there, also a great spot in there. That whole area by the Beltline holds a lot of panfish this time of year.
And breezing through the lakes, because as you said, game fish season isn't quite open yet. Let's wrap it up with Lake Wabisa. Have you heard anything coming out of there?
Again, good bluegill action down on the south end of the lake. So off Goodland Park in the area they call the South Bay down there has been holding some fish. I've heard about a few crappies coming out of the Bible Camp and Babcock Park areas. And, of course, I also want to mention that the area below the Babcock Dam is currently closed as a fish refuge there. So they close all those off because that current draws a lot of fish up, and the fish are easy pickings backed up at dams like that. So it's just to protect the spawning walleyes and stuff that come up through there.
And now one place you can be going for game fish right now is the river. So let's start off there. Let's hit with the Wisconsin River first off. What have you been hearing coming out of there?
Wisconsin River's been fishing really well. You know, with all the rain that we got, you'd think that the rivers, the levels would be up. But actually, they haven't come up. They've come up some, but it's not anywhere near what you'd consider high. And I believe the reason for that is, well, one, the rain, a lot of the rain is soaking into the ground, but then the rain that we're getting too is raising the river. But as the river flows south, they're raising a lot of the reservoirs. So if you know, locally on our end of the state, you've got Lake Wisconsin, Castle Rock Lake, Peyton Well, and they're raising the levels of those lakes. So a lot of the water is kind of soaked up in those and backed up there. But the walleye action at all the dams has been fantastic lately. I haven't heard that the walleyes have spawned yet, but the large females have moved in. So some great action for some real trophy fish at really any of the dams, but also in deeper holes and corners. If you can just find a little deeper water, you're likely to find fish. So great, great opportunity to get out and fish for those walleyes on the river.
And now heading in the opposite direction of Madison, the Rock River, what's happening there?
Well, the Rock River is a little bit of a different case. That rain that we got, really, they got pounded down south of Madison. So I saw as much as 3 inches of rain down there. And I know that it was running high for quite a while. Right after the rain, it's starting to come down, but it's still dirty. So the conditions aren't ideal, but there are fish backed up at a lot of the dams there as well. And they've been doing good for walleyes and sauger at especially the Jefferson Dam has been great, but really anywhere from Jefferson all the way down to Lake Koshkonong. If you can find deeper holes in there, you're likely to find fish.
And the last thing I want to touch on is the trout streams and everything like that. With all this rain that we've been getting, how have those been looking?
Well, you know, it's a similar thing to the larger rivers. That the rain that came through sort of is in a band that hit Madison here pretty good. And south of Madison got a lot of rain. But if you go to the north and west of Madison, they got rain, but they didn't get it that much. And a lot of that also soaked into the ground. So I was actually out trout fishing myself, what was it, Saturday. And I had creeks like Black Earth Creek, Gordon Creek, some of the more local creeks that are just to the west and southwest of Madison were high and dirty. But I kept driving west, and by the time I got west of Dodgeville, I was finding creeks that actually were still looking a little low, and they were very clear. So it varies on where you're going. And a lot of the streams south to the west here, I'm sure, have cleared up by now. But, yeah, they're running good, and this is a great time of year to get out. A lot of great trout fishing where you don't have to deal with weeds or bugs or heat or anything. Just enjoy the spring weather.
And we're just a couple weeks away from trout season opening up fully where you can keep them and use live bait, and just a few weeks away from a game fish season. So we're a little bit holding on for the moment, but coming up soon, it's going to get a little crazy. Well, Pat, that's about all we have for today. Do you have just any final advice for all the people out there?
Well, make sure you renew your license. Licenses did expire on March 31st. So if you haven't renewed your license, you can do that easy enough online. Of course, you can swing in the shop here, and we can get you set up if you're feeling technologically challenged. But, yeah, just make sure you're on the right side of the law and get out there and enjoy the wonderful spring weather we've got coming up.
I do still go in person to renew my license. I don't know why, but I just feel like I have to, and I have done that. So, yeah, make sure you go get a new license. Well, Pat, thank you for talking with me again this week. Remember, you can hear an updated fishing report anytime you want just by calling 608-BIG-FISH. Pat, thank you again, and good luck out there.
Always a pleasure, Nate. You take care.
It's 6:49 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. While Madison boasts many collegiate and amateur sports teams, it boasts only one professional sporting organization, Forward Madison Football Club. The Flamingos are set to host their 2024 league opener on Saturday at historic Breeze Stevens Field. And ahead of that, Forward Focus sat down with head coach Matt Glazer. More now from Andrew and Grant.
Oh, Hello again and welcome to everyone listening to WORT Online and at 89.9 FM on your radio dial. This is another edition of Forward Focus, a segment devoted to any and all things Forward Madison FC, Wisconsin's only fully professional soccer team. I'm one of your hosts, Grant Peters, assistant editor for Cultural and Forward Madison theme magazine, New Dogma Zine. As always, the editor of NDZ and the producer of Forward Focus is Andrew Schmidt. When we last left you, FMFC headed west to Fresno, California for a match against Central Valley Fuego FC. Despite losing leading scorer Christian Chaney to injury in the first half, the Mingos rallied and kicked the offense in high gear, getting goals from Derek Gebhardt and newcomers Devin Boyce and John Murphy to cruise to a 3-0 victory for their first USL 1 win of the season. Following that, FMFC traveled down to Bridgeport, Illinois for their next round matchup in the historic U.S. Open Cup against MLS Next Pro Squad, Chicago Fire 2 on Wednesday, April 3rd. Swirling winds, driving rain, and sleet, along with an injured Boyce and Chaney, short-circuited the FMFC offensive attack as they couldn't get anything going all match long. In the end, FMFC would crash out of the U.S. Open Cup, sending their cold, wet fans home on the heels of a 2-0 loss. For this week's segment, Andrew sat down again with Ford's head coach and technical director, Matt Glazer, to get his thoughts on the last two matches and, despite the loss in Chicago, how he feels the start of the 2024 campaign has been going. Andrew, take it away.
We are joined now by Matt Glazer, head coach and technical director of Forward Madison FC. Matt, thanks as always for joining us on Forward Focus.
Hey, Andrew, my pleasure, man. Always nice to chat. Hope things are well with you, man.
So last time we spoke was before the start of the new season. What do you make overall of your squad's performance thus far in the 2024 campaign?
Yeah, I think it's been a good start. Obviously a lot of road games, a lot of travel. So I think to be undefeated in the league is a good starting place. Would have liked to have won. Probably should have won the Tormenta game. Definitely should have won the Tormenta game. But then probably escaped Greenville with the point. And then definitely deserve to win the Central Valley game. So I think all things considered, 5 points from three, all on the road. We feel all right about it. Still early. Lots to improve and a long way to go yet. But I think it's a decent start. And obviously we're excited to get back home in front of you guys here this weekend.
You mentioned the Central Valley game. What do you think the squad did really well in that game to get control of it, start out on the front foot?
I thought we pressed really well, especially in the first half an hour or so. I don't think we let them out of their half too many times. And that sort of set the tone, being on the front foot. And then the chances that we created, we finished, and some of those were from winning it in the press. Some of it, there's a couple of goals from a nice little buildup, scored goals a couple of different ways. So that's always something that you want to be doing. But I think just us being on the front foot, being high pressing, putting the opponent under pressure, playing in their half, we were able to do that and do that well. And it helped us get a result over there.
Greenville is another team that has been a difficult one for us to play against, especially on the road. We still have not won in Greenville. Was that a frustrating match to come away with a point?
We had a tough travel day to get down there. The first half being really tough, the wind was blowing into us. I think the team that won the coin toss was going to have the better of it, at least for a half, and the wind was blowing in and tough to get out of our half. I didn't think we were very good in the first half. I thought in the second half much better, and probably had a few chances to steal a win. But obviously, Byrne played well. Defensively, we've been strong, continued to do that. But yeah, Greenville is always a tough place to go, especially now with where they play at Furman's Field. There, it's tight. It's windy. It's football lines. It's definitely a tough place to go and try and win a game. So, all things considered, I think a point, wasn't the end of the world there.
You mentioned the cup. Disappointingly, our run ended early. The weather conditions were also pretty intense this past Wednesday for the U.S. Open Cup game away to Chicago Fire's reserves. The squad losing 2-0, held scoreless for a second time in 2024.
We didn't play very well. It happens, with the road stretch that we've been on. I think over the weekend coming back from California, we had a 17-hour travel day to get home. Picked up some injuries over some of the travel and road games that we'd had early. You know, it was pragmatic to rotate the team a little bit, give some other guys an opportunity. And I just didn't think we played very well, to be honest, in the Chicago game. And it was a tough, you mentioned the conditions. It's always, tough in the travel. But we, we can't really use that as an excuse. I think I just didn't think we played very well. We weren't the best version of ourselves, and lots to improve. So got some good video from that game and a good learning experience for a lot of our guys, and hopefully we improve and bounce back and take advantage this weekend.
The home league opener, extra spicy due to the fan rivalry between Madison and Richmond. The Henny Derby, what does this game mean each year, especially when we host? And what does the Derby mean to the coaches and the squad?
Yeah, it's obviously always a big game with Richmond and historic club and the team we've had some good battles with over the last few years. And obviously we want to win the Henny Derby for the fans, and that's something that the guys are aware of from having done it last year. And I think it just puts a little bit of extra emphasis on it, but always a game that we want to win and against a tough opponent. So it's usually a pretty good matchup.
Orrin Madison FC is back in action this Saturday as they have their USL1 home opener at historic Bree Stevens Field against the rival Richmond Kickers in the season's first matchup of the illustrious Henny Derby. Kickoff is at 6 p.m. and live coverage is available on ESPN+. Following that, FMFC will take on the University of Wisconsin in an exhibition match on April 20th in the Battle for Madison. Kickoff is at 5 p.m. There will be no live coverage of the match, so if you want to see it, you'll need to be at Breeze. And that'll do it for this week. As always, we hope that you'll join us again as Andrew and I continue to keep you up to date on all the news, updates, and stories coming out of Bree Stevens Field as Forward Madison continues their quest for USL1 glory. For WORT, this has been Forward Focus.
And that's a wrap for WORT's live local news at 6. Russ Mackey was your headline writer. Your reporter tonight was Sarah Gabler. Special thanks to feature contributors Dylan Brogren and Tom Kamenick, Nate Wiegehout and Pat Hansberg, and the Forward Focus crew. Super Dave Lorenz engineered the show. Faye Parks produced this newscast, and Ms. Sholly Pittman is the news director here at WORT. Thank you guys for listening. I'm your host, Marcus Slayton.
And I'm Christina Leffring. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is the Perpetual Notion Machine. Have a good night.
Hi, I'm Mel from the Mel and Floyd Show.
And I'm Mr. Smarty Pants.
If you have an old car or truck you don't want anymore, help yourself and WRT by donating it to your favorite radio station.
It's stupid easy, which is the best kind of easy. Just call 833-WRT-CAR and arrange for someone to swing by and pick it up. It takes about 5 minutes. You get rid of that old clunker and WRT can turn it into cash.
It doesn't matter if the car runs or not. Call from any of the 50 states.
Speaking of 50, Mel, there must be at least 50 ways to donate your car to WRT.
Sure are. Give up your van, Stan.
Get a new truck, Chuck.
Donate that Kia, Rhea.
We'll take that Saab, Bob.
Even a Lamborghini, weenie.
So call 833-WRT-CAR and donate that old car, truck, or Stanley Steamer to WRT today.
We promise life will never be the same again.
You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM, Madison. Coming up next, Perpetual Notion Machine.
True Endeavors presents Suzanne Vega, Old Songs, New Songs, and Other Songs Tour at the Barrymore on Tuesday, April 23rd. Widely regarded as one of the foremost songwriters of her generation, Suzanne Vega emerged as a leading figure of the folk revival of the early 1980s. Since the release of her self-titled, critically acclaimed 1985 debut album, she has been known for performances that convey deep emotion, and on this current tour, she is reaching into her catalog to play hits and cover songs by Lou Reed, Duncan Sheik, and others. True Endeavors presents Suzanne Vega Old Songs, New Songs, and Other Songs Tour at the Barrymore on Tuesday, April 23rd at 7:30 p.m. More information at barrymorelive.com. Live music lives at WORT Madison.
Good evening and welcome to the Perpetual Notion Machine on WORT 89.9 FM, listener-supported community radio in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm your host, Catherine Garvins. On tonight's show, we will hear my interview with Eric Carson. Eric is a geologist and professor with the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His primary research focuses on the processes and sedimentary archives of streams near former glacial margins. The Driftless area of southwestern Wisconsin is a prime example of this geomorphic setting and a major geographic focus for his research. Excerpts from this interview appeared in a 2023 Perpetual Notion Machine show on land conservation in the Driftless area. Tonight,